Again, want to talk today about something that I really struggle with as a business guy, and particularly as a young businessman and a Christian. I really struggle with a number of things, and the little book that I wrote, How Then Should We Work, really kind of walks through five specific areas that I had to kind of come to grips with, really understand how my work and my faith were to come together and be integrated in my life. And really, the first one was the idea of the four-chapter gospel, which I introduced to you last night. The second one was the idea of the cultural mandate, the fact that we're here to fill and subdue the earth. We talked about that a little last night. The other three basically were the kingdom of God, the whole idea of common grace, and the last, and probably most difficult for me to kind of come to grips with, was the biblical meaning of success. I can remember being in a church, actually a church I went to, and heard the pastor give a sermon one time on commitment. Excuse me, not commitment, on contentment. And he said, you know, you just have to learn how to be content with what you have. And he had all these biblical stories and stuff to go with it. And so when I walked out, I said, Pastor, does that mean tomorrow when I go to work, I don't want to work hard and try to win that new job and expand my business and hire more people? And he goes, oh, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I said, but that's what you said. He goes, no, he says, I'm talking about spiritual things. That's something secular. See, because he had the same problem with the spiritual secular divide, right? But if everything is spiritual, how can I understand success from the biblical perspective? So that's what I want to talk to you about a little bit this morning. One of the problems that compounds this issue is the fact that we've been lied to by our culture. I'm going to suggest that the culture tells us two great lies. Unfortunately, a lot of you have been homeschooled, so you haven't heard it in your schools, but you hear it on TV, you hear it when you go to college, even if you go to a Christian school, you'll hear this. The first great lie, tell me you haven't heard this, you could be anything you want to be. In the United States, we couch this in these parables like, in the United States, anybody can grow up to be president. You know that's not true, right? But yet it's said over and over, it's said so much that almost anyone believes it. I have to admit it, coming out of school, coming out of high school, I bought into this, right? I was a pretty big guy. I was playing football in high school. I thought I was pretty good. I was going to go up to the University of Florida to play football. I was 6'4", 240 pounds. And this is remedially back in the last century, in 1970, right? That was the size of tight ends in the NFL. So I thought, well, I'm going to go play tight end. Got up to Florida. Not only was I, of course, the problem was I was quick, but they were fast. And you guys that play sports know that speed kills sports. I mean, and the problem I had is I quickly realized not only was I not ever going to play in the NFL, I wasn't even going to play in the SEC. I just wasn't good enough. And it didn't matter. I mean, I couldn't do anything that I wanted to. It was a rude awakening to me. But I want to tell you, that's really true. That's the first great lie. Second great lie is similar, and I think even more dangerous, and really sets us up for failure. The second great lie is, you can be the best in the world. Let me tell you, no matter what it is, if you're a violinist, if you are a soccer player, I mean, make a list. There's only one best in the world, and it's probably not going to be you, just statistically, right? Now, I hope maybe there's the best of the world's people in this group. Maybe so, right? But understand, it's very rare. And this idea that you could be anything you want to be and you could be best in the world is just insane. I heard a story recently about a young woman who was an incredibly gifted violinist. And everybody in her town said, you know, you're obviously going to be you're going to be the best in the world. And so she got a full-ride scholarship to go to Juilliard and gets on the train and goes to New York City. And as she's getting off the train, someone is standing there playing a violin with a hat begging for money, right? And she realized that guy is better than she is. He can't be the best in the world, probably. You can't do anything you want to do. As Christians, what we need to understand is that we can only really do and really be successful and be the best that we can be at doing what God wants us to do. Okay? So how do we think about it? How do we add this? First of all, I don't want you to take my word for it that I'm just not making this up about these lies, right? Let me give you a quote from a little book. This is a book called The Dip. This author is a very famous business author. He sells tons of books all the time. He's one of his business gurus, right? This particular book, I spent 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, sold more than 100,000 copies in the first month. Let me read you a quote from this book, okay? Because his basis, his premise for this whole little book is around one of these great lies. Listen to this. Hannah Smith is a very lucky woman. She's a law clerk in the Supreme Court. She's the best in the world. Last year, more than 42,000 people graduated from law school in the United States, and 37 of them were awarded Supreme Court clerkships. Here it comes. Any one of the 42,000 who graduated from law school last year could have had Hannah's job. That's just not true. That's an out-and-out fabrication. Yet it's the basis for the whole rest of this book, right? I mean, think about it. There's some guy at Illinois State Law School, right, that he worked as hard as he could and he barely passed. There's no way in the world he's ever going to be a Supreme Court clerk. It's just not going to happen, right? Here's another interesting thing. I was using this example at a talk one time, and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, I know Hannah Smith. She was one of my classmates at Princeton. He said, not only was she the smartest person in our class, but she worked harder than anybody else in the class and was the top of her class at Princeton. Could have gone to any law school in the United States. Harvard, Yale, would have begged for her to come there. Guess where she went? Brigham Young. You see, Hannah Smith was a Mormon. So she went to Brigham Young Law School, top of her class, graduates, and what does she want to do? She wants to be a Supreme Court clerk. There had never been a Mormon in the history of the United States that had clerked for the Supreme Court. And so she put it out that she wanted to do that. Do you not believe that she had all sorts of people in very high places pulling strings to help her get that job? So even if the story's true, it's still not true, right? She didn't get the job on her own. She had people helping her because there are all these important business people wanted a Mormon to clerk on the Supreme Court. So that whole illustration is just a fabrication to support a lie that's been told over and over again in our community. Don't buy into these two great lies. Because what it's done, it's set a whole generation, you know, the millennials, which you guys are not part of, most of you are not part of, set them up for failure because they've been told that over and over again. So they get out in the workforce and all of a sudden they realize they can't be the best in the world and they're incredibly disappointed. And so what do? They look for satisfaction and significance in other places than their work. And as I said last night, and I'll say this again, God has given us our work as one of the primary means to find satisfaction and purpose in our lives in this place and in this time. Particularly if we are working to glorify Him and serve the common good as He's commanded us. So let me lay another layer on this, because these lies have been so exasperated in our culture. And we've laid some other things on it that are making it even worse. I want to play you a clip from a movie. Interesting enough, this movie was over 30 years ago. But it's one of the most often quoted, particularly in business.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Now, it's interesting because that one piece in that film, Greed is Good, is quoted over and over and over again. You see, in the United States, the system that most of our businesses operate in is what's called the free market capitalist system. And what's been portrayed, another one of the great lies, is that it's based on greed. Now, if the essence of capitalism is greed, we're in trouble because as Christians, Right? From a Christian perspective, greed is not good. In fact, it's often translated in the Bible as covetousness. Jesus says, beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has abundance does his life consist of his possessions. So as Christians, we reject that greed is good. That greed is not good. It's one of the worst things that you can embrace in your life. So then how do we think about a capitalist system that some people say is built on greed when we're not supposed to be greedy people, right? And I would argue that greed is a terrible thing. It's caused a tremendous amount of damage. So let's go back and talk for just a minute about the definition of greed. And that definition has changed over the last 20, 30, 40 years. If you go to Webster's Dictionary today and read the definition of greed, you'll read this. Greed is a selfish and excessive desire for more of something, such as money, than is needed. Now think about that for a second. That's a very relativistic definition, right? Who decides how much of something you need? Is it your parents? Is it the government? Is it the church? I mean, and do different people need different amounts? This is a very dangerous definition. This is not the Bible's definition of greed. Let me show you what how the Bible defines greed. The Bible says that greed is wanting or taking of something that is not rightfully yours. You see that the Bible, as usual, goes back to an absolute. This is not yours. If you take it, that's greed. Or even if you want it, that's greed. Something that's not rightfully yours. As opposed to the world's definition, which is relative, it can be changed. You know, it's a huge difference. Now, if we go back to the 1700s, when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, he said this. A very familiar quote, and if you haven't heard it before, you will. It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-interest. Now, unfortunately, in today's culture, today's society, far too often, self-interest is equated to greed. And that's not the case. We need to separate those. There's nothing wrong with self-interest. In fact, I'm going to suggest this morning that self-interest is a biblical idea. Let me show you. Philippians 2:4. Paul says this. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, to his own self-interest, right, but also to the interest of others. So Paul's not saying self-interest is bad. He said you need to take care of your own self-interest. But you also need to look after the self-interest of others. And that's okay, right? In Jeremiah 29:7, we see Jeremiah the prophet sending a letter to the exiles that have been taken out of Israel that are in Babylon. And he tells them a bunch of things, but in 29:7 he tells them, work for the peace and prosperity. Work for the flourishing of the city that have taken you to exile. Because if it flourishes, you too flourish. That is the essential ingredient of every successful business that's ever been started and run. If you take care of your client, they'll take care of you. Right? You work for the peace and prosperity of someone else, and you'll get peace and prosperity. That's in your best self-interest. Even Jesus appeals to self-interest. He says, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? What Jesus is telling us is the gospel is in our own best self-interest. Right? So the Bible appeals, and I can show you more scriptures, but you get the point. The Bible appeals to our self-interest. Self-interest is very different than greed. Although in today's culture, they want to put them together. Because people want to be greedy, and they want to justify their sin. And you'll see this. This is why that movie's been so embraced by so many evil business people. and we see so much corruption in business. But I get ahead of myself. Go to this.
Make it your ambition to live a quiet life, to mind your own business, to work with your hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders, and so that you will not be dependent on anybody.
Before I was interrupted by the Apostle Paul there, who makes a very important point, right? I wanted to say that the Reformers got this, right? They understood this. In fact, there are many historians, even non-Christian historians, that will tell you that it's the Reformers who really laid down kind of this theological foundation, and the fields that they plowed theologically is really what lets capitalism that we know today really take root in Europe in the 16th and 17th century. There's one particular historian I read all the time who claims he's an agnostic. His name is Niall Ferguson. And Niall Ferguson has written a number of books. He wrote one about the history of Western civilization. He says Western civilization was better than any other civilization because it had six killer apps that no other civilization ever had. And guess which one of those killer apps was, in his estimation? The Protestant work ethic that grows up out of the Reformation. Understanding that God's called us to work and that we're to do the work at the best of our abilities. And it's to serve others. This kind of idea of biblical self-interest. Ferguson says it built Europe. He says it came across the ocean but with the Puritans. It built the United States. He says you can't find a trace of it in Europe anymore. He says you can barely find a trace of it in the United States. But then he suggests it's live and well. Guess where? It's alive and well, he says, in China. And he says there's a connection between the rise of Christianity in China and the rise of capitalism. I think he's right. Let me ask you a question. How many here, by raise of hands, thinks that poverty is getting worse in the world today? How many people think that? Okay, quite a few. How many people think it's getting less? There's less poverty today than ever. Good, this is a very enlightened crowd. The second one group is right. Interesting enough, in a poll recently done by Barna, 80% of evangelical Christians in the United States think poverty is getting worse. Because that's what we're told all the time in the media. Just the opposite is true. In fact, the World Bank, not a hotbed for conservative thought by any stretch of the imagination, put out a report several years ago. In the report, they made two incredibly important statements that most people are blown away when they hear about it. In fact, it was so significant, you can't hardly even find it on their webpage anymore. They buried it, right? The first was that in the last 30 years, more people have been raised out of abject poverty. And abject poverty, what I mean by that is living on less than a dollar and a half a day. That's the UN definition of abject poverty. More people in the last 30 years have been raised out of abject poverty than in the entire rest of the history of the world combined. That's an amazing statistic. But it doesn't end there. The report goes on and says, if we continue on our current trend, on our current trajectory, in the next 25 years, we will wipe abject poverty off the face of the map. There will no longer be any abject poverty in the world. That, indeed, is an incredible statement. You don't hear that on CNN. You don't read that in the newspaper. And I tell you why. The reason is, what's driving that incredible movement to raise all these people out of poverty is not any specific government program. It's not a program by the UN. It's not even because of Christian charity. You know what's driving it? Something I call economic freedom. The freedom in places like China and India to go start your own business, to profit from the work of your hands, to employ other people, to pull yourself up and create something, a life for yourself and your family. That's what's driving it. And as Christians, we should be concerned about poverty. And if we're concerned about poverty, we should be concerned about spreading the whole idea of economic freedom, which is a whole other lecture. I don't want to go there, but I do want to lay that out. A friend of ours, who's now actually with the Lord, he just died a couple of years ago, Michael Novak, wrote this in a classical book. And if you're interested in business, you need to go read this book. It's written almost 20 years ago. It's called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. He says this, democratic capitalism is neither the kingdom of God nor without sin. Yet all other known systems of political economics are worse. Such hope as we have for alleviating poverty and for removing oppressive tyranny, perhaps our last best hope lies in this much despised system. I have a friend named Ken Barnes. He just wrote a book that's just been published. It's called Redeeming Capitalism. And in that book, he calls out to Christians. He says, you know, if you go back to the 1700s and you study capitalism then, and you read the stuff, that quotes like I quoted from Adam Smith and people, they were writing about traditional capitalism. That was, you know, couched in this Protestant work ethic. Christian ethics were just shot through capitalism. If you go back to the early 1700s and read some stuff by a guy named Max Weber, who was called the father of sociology, interesting enough, he wrote a lot about the Protestant work ethic, you see that capitalism's changed a little bit. It's no longer so strongly connected to kind of Christianity, although, and particularly Protestant Christianity, although it still has some trappings of the ethics and the Christian ethics and honesty and virtue, and those things are still there. Then he says, fast forward to today. And the problem today is we don't have traditional capitalism. We don't have modern capitalism. What we have today is postmodern capitalism. And it's completely unmoored for any type of ethics or any type of truth, which you'd expect from a postmodern society, right? So that business people can literally do anything they want. They don't have to be honest. In fact, it's fascinating. I wrote a blog about this just recently. If you Google the word transparency, which is everyone screaming for, we need more transparency in government and business, more transparency. If you Google that, you'll find all these articles where it talks about transparency and integrity as if they're the same. The reality is they're diametrically opposed to one another. Think about it. If I want transparency, what I'm saying is I don't trust you to do the right thing, so I want to watch you to make sure that you're going to do the right thing. See, but the transparency never works. Because if I want to cheat you, you can't watch me 24/7. You just can't do it. So all these screams for transparency, it's a waste of time. See, what we need back in capitalism, and this is what Barnes argues in his books, we need these Christian values of honesty, integrity, the things that made capitalism work for so many years that now in our postmodern capitalism, people have just walked away from. And he says, if we don't get this back, we will kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And I believe he's right. And I believe it's incumbent upon you and your generation to right the ship. Enough of the sermon. But I think that's really the case. So, let's go back to this idea of success and finding out what the secret of success is. Tim Keller talks about success becoming one of the great idols in our culture today. He writes this in his book, Counterfeit Gods. He says, more than other idols, personal success and achievement lead to the sense that we ourselves are God, that our security and value rest in our own wisdom, strength, and performance. To be the very best at what you do, to be at the top of the heap, means no one is like you. You are supreme. But I tell you, that's a dangerous place to be. But we have a culture today that's driving that kind of thinking. Now, let me introduce you to one of my people I really admired growing up. In fact, in the 70s, he was the best in the world at what he did. His name is John Wooden, the basketball coach, coached at UCLA in California. And he won 9 NCAA national championships in basketball in 11 years. A feat I'm sure that will never be repeated. He truly was the best in the world at what he did. Yet what a lot of people don't know about him is he was a very committed Christian. And one time he was asked, what is your definition of success? What for you, what is success? Define that for us. And here's what he said. He said, success is the peace of mind, which is a direct result of the self-satisfaction in knowing you did your best to become the best that you're capable of becoming. Now, understand, that's not an absolute thing. He said, you know, success is not becoming the best in the world, right? It's being the best that you could be. Now, he went on and talked about there were times when his basketball team lost. Now, admittedly, there weren't very many, but there were times when he lost. And some of those losses, he was furious with this team. Why? Because they didn't play up to their potential. But there were other times when they lost, and once again, just a handful, when he was fine, because they played as good as they could play. They just played a better team that time, that game. And that was okay. And I'm going to suggest to you this morning that I think I know where John Wooden got this ingredient or got this definition for success. And I think it's a biblical definition. I think he got it from a parable called the Parable of the Talents. Probably one of the most famous parables in the Bible. I mean, we've all heard many sermons preached on it. I think if we look at this parable, we'll really begin to see and glean a biblical basis for understanding how God wants us to be successful. Now, like I said, it's a very common parable. A lot of people know it. One of the problems I think we have when we study the Bible, and once again, I'm going to give you a little bit of my prejudice, I have a sense that we chop the Bible up into so many little pieces, then we look at one little piece and we don't see it in a larger context. So I want to give you a little context behind the parable of the talents this morning. It actually takes place during Holy Week, during the last week of Jesus' life, probably on the Tuesday before Good Friday. And Jesus and the disciples go into the temple for the last time. Now, this is a model of the best guess of what the temple looked like in Jesus' day. It's actually in Jerusalem. I've been there. They have a model of the entire city, but this is the model of what the Temple Mount looked like and what the temple looked like. Now, this was not the great temple that was built by Solomon. That was destroyed by the Babylonians. This is the second temple, what they call the second temple. That was actually built by Herod the Great, who was also called Herod the Builder. And it's no small thing, right? In fact, many people say at that time it was built, it was probably one of the great seven architectural feats in the world at that time. Incredible place, right? So Jesus has had a big argument with the Pharisees in the temple for the last time. The few Pharisees that weren't ready to kill him now are ready to kill him. And so they leave, and as they're walking away from the temple, he overhears a couple of his disciples saying, man, is this place just too cool, right? This is just an awesome place, right? And Jesus turns to them, and he says this. He says, do you see all these things, he asks? Truly, I tell you, not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. Now, I want you to know, for a Jew, the temple was the center of their worship. It was important under so many different levels that it was unthinkable to the disciples that this could possibly happen. And for Jesus just to say this out of blue really just kind of freaked them out, right? So as they were leaving, if you remember your stories about Holy Week, Jesus didn't stay in Jerusalem. He stayed in Bethany with his friends, with Martha and Mary and his other friend, who his name is Lazarus. There you go. The one he raised from the dead. I should remember that. I'm just testing you. I really knew it all along. So they're on the way over there. It's a fair walk, right? So you have to go up. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, you've been on the Temple Mount, you have to go down through the valley, and then you come up on the other side. You go across the top of the Mount of Olives. This is kind of what it looks like from the Mount of Olives. And then you go down in the next valley, and Bethany's there. So they stop up on top of the Mount of Olives, and from the Mount of Olives, you look back, and you can see the temple. This is probably about what it looked like. And they sat down to rest, and the disciples come to Jesus and said, what in the world were you talking about back there? You gotta explain this to us. And so Jesus sits down, and lectures his disciples. And you can find this in the 24th and 25th chapter of Matthew. And this discussion is often called the Olivet Discourse, because it's a discourse Jesus gives on the Mount of Olives, the last week of his life. It's an incredibly important discourse. And in it, he starts, but he says to the disciples, came to them and said, tell us, you know, when's this going to happen? When's the destruction going to come? And what will be the signs of your coming in the end of the age? So Jesus sits down and answers those questions in quite some detail. In fact, if we would outline it, it would look something like this. If we were going to do a Bible study, this is what it would look like. You know, you've got the questions from the disciples. Jesus talks about specific signs of the end of the age. He talks about general signs of the end of the age. Then he gives them a command to be vigilant. And to reinforce that command to be vigilant, he gives them three parables. Three parables I'm sure that you guys all know well. The first one is the story of the wise servant. The second is the parable of the 10 virgins. And the last one is the one we want to look at, the parable of the talent. It's interesting, if you look at these three things, they're all tied around this idea of be vigilant, right? And the first parable really talks about be watching for the return. Be watching for the signs of the return of the king. The second one, the one of the 10 virgins, talks about be ready. Live your life ready, right? I tell people all the time, we have to live our lives like we think Jesus Christ is coming tomorrow. If you knew for a fact Jesus Christ was coming at noon tomorrow, what would you do different today that you probably won't do? Well, you should live your life that way. You should live your life that as if we believe he's coming tomorrow. But at the same time, we have to be willing to wait for him for another 1,000 years, right? So there's a tension there, but we need to live our lives in that tension. The last one, the parable we want to look at, the parable of talents, he tells them to be working. Okay? So he tells them to be watching, to be ready, and to be working. See, we're not just to sit around and wait until the king comes back. He's given us something to do, to fill the earth with images and subdue the earth. We've got to be doing that while we wait for the return of the king. That's what part of what this parable is about. And then the final section is on the final judgment when he comes the second time. Issues in his kingdom in its fullness. And restores everything back to the way it was supposed to be. Now, let's look at this parable. This is one we all know well. It starts off as saying it would be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them with his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1. Each according to his own ability. Then he went away. Now, there's a couple words in this passage that we just gross over. And I think it holds the key to understanding this passage, particularly when we think about work and the success. What does biblical success look like? And it's simply these couple words. Each according to his own ability. Now, if you wrote this parable today, you couldn't get away with this, could you? You'd have to give each, and I'm not a math guy, so let's see. So if you've got 5 talents, 2 talents, 1 talent, what's that? 8 talents, divide that by 3, I'm sure somebody's... It's a little less than the 3 talents a piece, like 2.75, whatever it is, right? You'd have to give each one the same amount. So it's unfair to do it any other way, right? You couldn't get away with doing this story today. People would just go crazy. But see, the master understood who the servants were. He understood their talents, right? He understood what they were capable of. So one he gave 5 talents, one he gave 2 talents, one he gave 1 talent. Then he went away. We don't know for how long, but we know that when he went away, there was a sense by the workers that he was going to come back. And when he'd come back, he would settle with them, right? And this was pretty typical. If you look at that time, guys did this all the time. Rich guys like this would have 4 or 5 estates, and they would circulate. They'd spend 3 months at one estate, then they'd go to the next one, then they'd go and they'd move around. So they know he's coming back, so they know there's a certain amount of time. We don't know what that set of time is, but they probably knew. I had a pretty good idea when he would be back. One thing I did one time when I was doing a Bible study, I thought, you know, I wonder what a talent is worth in today's dollars. Because, you know, I'll be honest with you, growing up as a kid, I always heard this parable. I always felt like the guy only got 1 talent really got kind of ripped off a little bit by the owner, right? You know, I mean, because in my mind, he got 1 crummy little coin. You know, what did the owner expect? All he got was 1 talent. You know, kind of wasn't fair to that guy. You know, you got to set a guy 5 talents, right? So I did the math. Conservatively, in today's dollars, a talent's worth over $1 million. So the guy that got 1 talent took $1 million or more and buried it in his backyard. No wonder the master was upset. Does that not change that story a little bit? Interesting enough, most of the sermons I've heard on this passage, the emphasis is on the guy with the 1 talent, right? And how he really got in trouble. And look, we don't want to be that guy. But very few pastors in sermons I've heard really talk about the other 2 guys. They're the 2 guys we want to emulate, right? Think about this for a second. One of those guys got over $5 million, went out into the workplace, went out into the market, and made $5 million more dollars in 6 months, 9 months, a year, we don't know how long. It was probably less than a year. Now, if you did that today, that'd be pretty impressed, right? The guy would be really good. But to do it in their economy, that guy was like a Steve Jobs. He was like an incredible business guy, right? Even the guy had got the $2 million. He went out and made $2 million more dollars in some short span of time. It wasn't bad either. Those are the people we want to be like, right? Because, see, they understood their responsibility. They knew God had given them, or I say God, the master, in our case, God, we have to consider this, in this story, the master is God, gave them certain talents and opportunities, and that he expected a return on his investment. Let me tell you, God expects a return on his investment from each one of you. It cost him dearly to bring you into the kingdom of heaven. Dearly. As we heard last night. The cost of his own son, the blood of his own son. And he expects a return on his investment. Now, I'm not talking about your salvation or earning your salvation. What I'm talking about is responding to God's call in your life in the here and now and going out and doing things with the things he's given you, right? This whole idea I talked about yesterday about being a sub-creator to do what God intends for you to do. Here's the interesting thing about this story. We know what happens to the guy that buries the $1 million in the ground. What happens to the other 2 guys? The first one, God says, or the master says to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a little. I will see that you are put over much. Enter into the joy of the master." That's the $5 million guy, right? Makes $5 million out of $5 million. What was the reward for the $2 million guy? Exactly the same. Wait a minute. That can't be right. You know? And today, we would not do that, right? You know, some business guy that you've never heard of, kind of middle-of-the-road business guy, you don't even know who he is. But the Steve Jobs of the world, you know who they are because we give them more honor and glory and we hold them up as examples, right? It's not what the master does because that's not what God does. Let me ask you something. How hard did the guy have to work to take the $5 million and make $5 million more? To work as hard as he could. How hard did the guy that took $2 million, how hard did he have to work to make $2 million or more? He had to work as hard as he could. Do you see what this parable is telling us? You don't have to be the best in the world. You don't have to be a 5-talent guy. All you have to do is take the things God has given you and go out and work as hard as you can to make a return for the master. Do the best you can with what you've got. It's interesting, if you go back and look at the early church, really up to the time of the Reformation, this story, the word talent was seen as only as a spiritual gift. And it's actually John Calvin in his commentaries that gives us the definition of talent that we use today. That it's an ability to do something well, right? And that comes out of Calvin's commentary. And he said, this is not about just doing work in the church. This is about all the work we're called to do. The work we're called to do in the church, yes, but also in our vocational call. Also in our called to our family. Also in the work we're called to do in our communities. All those things, right? So what's this look like as a student, right? Let me tell you, one of my best friends, I sent him a copy of this book in my little book, How This Would Work. There's a chapter about this. He wrote me back and said, I was blown away when I read this. He said, you know, I went to college and I went on to law school. And he said, you know, I bought into this thing I could be the best in the world. But he says, I quickly found there were guys that were a lot smarter than I were. And they were just better at being lawyers. And I realized I was kind of a middle-of-the-road lawyer. And he said, that bothered me because, you know, it was like, why can't I do better? Because he was comparing himself. He was a two-talent guy comparing himself to a five-talent guy. You don't want to do that. And you don't have to do it in God's economy. All you have to do is be the best two-talent guy you can be, and you will be rewarded just like the five-talent guy. There was a time in my life that I've taught Sunday school and done all these things, and you know, I would look at guys like Rabbi Zacharias or R.C. Sproul, and you know, one day I'm going to be like them. I'm going to be just as good as they are. Because I can do anything, you know, and I can be anything, and I can be the best in the world. And some place in my career as a biblical teacher, right, I began to realize my career was kind of stalling. And that, you know, I was never going to be a Rabbi Zacharias. Not only that, I began to realize those guys are a lot smarter than I am. And what should have been one of the worst, depressing days of my life was one of the best, because I was studying to do a Bible study on the parable of talents, and I realized that I don't have to be the best in the world. All I have to do is go out and take the gifts God's given me and do the best I can. What you're seeing is a two-talent guy doing the best he can. And that's all God's called me to do. Right? It still takes a lot of work. I have to work just as hard as those guys do. And it would seem like I'm getting cheated because I'm getting less of a return, but I'm not, because here's what I thought, right? So I thought, okay, when we get to the wedding feast of the Lamb, right, and we're all sitting around this big table, right, you know, the Rabbi Zacharias will be there, and Billy Graham will be there, and all these, you know, five-talent guys, right? And Hugh Welch, well, I'll be sitting way in the back someplace. Let me tell you what God showed me that day, and I believe this is true from this story. You do what God's called you to do, and you do the best that you can, whether you're a student now, or you're going to business later, or you become a mom that stays home and homeschools her kids and raises her family, you realize that's just as important as the woman that's raising a Fortune 5, that's running a Fortune 500 company. That's what God's called you to do for that season of your life. You need to sort all that out, right? But whatever God's called you to do for that season of your life, if you do it the best that you can, when this is all said and done, guess where you're going to sit? You're going to sit right up in front, right between Rabbi Zacharias and Billy Graham. That's what God showed me. And I believe that's the truth. I believe that's what this parable is trying to tell us. We don't want to be the guy with the one talent. That's for sure. We want to be the five-talent guy. And there may be some five-talent guys in this room, you know. And if there are, you're going to be held accountable to that. If you're a five-talent guy, you can't slough off and just be a two-talent guy, right? Or gal. But the objective is not to compare yourself to other people. That's a trap that only leads to disappointment. God has plans for you, incredible plans, for you to flourish by bringing flourishing to the world that He so loves. So let me give you the best shot at my definition of success from the Bible. Success is faithfully using all that God has given us, bringing about more flourishing. This work should bring us both joy and peace of mind, knowing that we have done our best through the power of Christ working through us to accomplish what He has called us to do to make a difference in the world in which we live. One last thing about wealth creation, because there's a lot of concern about wealth creation, right? Money is just a tool. And once you get in the business, you have to realize that. And there's nothing wrong with creating wealth. In fact, I would argue that there are people in this room that God is going to call to go out and start business and create great wealth. And that's a good thing. Because, see, one of the problems we have is this idea we have a scarcity mentality sometimes. I think if I get more wealth, that means I have to take it from someone else. This is what we call in economics the the pie theory, right? The pie is only a certain size, and for me to give a bigger piece, someone else has a smaller piece. No, that's not true. The tool that God's given us in the free market allows us to make more and more pies. There are plenty of pies to go around. So some of you will be called to go out and create great wealth, right? There's a lot about wealth in the Bible, and I won't go into it, just to say that that God wants us to use all the talents and all the resources He's given us. But we can't get tripped up by you know, what they'll buy or what they'll do. What we have to do is, He's given us these things to bring about flourishing to the communities that we are required to serve. So let me close with one last example. This is one of my favorite sermons by John Wesley. It's a sermon on money. And basically, like any good preacher, he's got 3 points. And his first point is simply this: gain all you can. What he means is make all the money you can. Second thing he says is save all you can. And really, what he's not talking about saving like we think about it. He's talking about taking the money that you make and then reinvesting it in people and other things to bring a larger return, right? So we're told not to take our money and put it in the barn, right? That there's a danger of people just saving up huge amounts of money so they don't have to worry anymore. God warns against that. We're to take the money we make and reinvest it in things God wants us to reinvest in. So that's really what he's saying. And the last one, he says, give away all the money you can. And best I could tell, reading from biographies and autobiographies of Wesley, he lived his life that way. He was incredibly generous. He didn't make a lot of money, but he was able to redistribute a lot of money to people that really needed it and help people get up and get going. I mean, one of the things that's interesting when we talk about poverty, and I'll close on this, there's two theories about poverty in the world, right? One of them is, I call the give a fish approach. The other is the teach a guy to fish approach, right? And the problem is, give a guy a fish, is after he's ate the next day, he's going to be hungry again. You've got to give him a fish the next day. Long term, that's a bad strategy. But the problem on this side with the give a guy, or teach a guy to fish strategy, is that if a guy is starving and you're trying to teach him how to fish, he's going to eat the bait, right? It just doesn't work, right? So what you have to do is have a balanced approach. And I have a lot of friends that have done a lot of work in poverty, and we've written a lot about poverty. And so you have to get people, if you're going to give the money away, you have to understand that there's a thing called charity, there's a thing called philanthropy, and they're very different. You know, charity, you give something to someone not expecting anything in return. Philanthropy, you give something to someone expecting them to live differently, to act differently. So you have to combine those two. You have to get people out of the place where they can help themselves to a place where they can help themselves. One of the guys that was really good about that was John Wesley. He lived a life where he did that continually. You read all sorts of examples. And it's an illustration of how we're to help people that are in poverty. So anyway, I'll end there, and we'll pick this up next time. Thank you.